The Chicago Blackhawks has set a new franchise record for consecutive wins in the regular season. 12 in a row for the Chicago Blackhawks.
Governor Rick Snyder appealing to the people of Flint, Michigan.
I'm sorry most of all that I let you down. You deserve better.
Todd and I and a couple of our friends here from Alaska lending our support for the next president of our great United States of America, Donald J. Trump.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09. Today is January 20th, 2016. Welcome to the program. Allow yourself a lot of extra time this morning. If you're just waking up and getting out, the roads are slippery in many places overnight. Just enough snow and freezing precipitation to make things slippery and dangerous. You're going to need a little extra time, especially if you have any sort of devices that are frozen. My parking garage gate was frozen shut this morning. I guess it was the freezing rain that started first and then the snow, and so I had to push it open manually. So that's the kind of little problems that you might face as you get up this morning. When we say allow extra time, that's exactly what we mean. Overseas tonight, overnight, the Asian markets continue to tumble. This comes after the IMF's lower growth forecast added anxiety over the Wall Street turbulence and also the Chinese economy that continues to show weakness. As you heard Vic report in the news at the top of the hour, Tokyo's Nikkei fell 1,642 was the reading on that overnight. The Hang Seng retreated. The Nikkei actually fell about 4%, lost about 4% of its volume. The Shanghai lost about 1.3%. South Korea off as well. U.S. stocks struggled through turbulent trading Tuesday, but they did eke out some small gains led by utility and consumer stocks. As a matter of fact, suburban Chicago-based McDonald's was one of the stronger stocks yesterday, pushing the Dow as much as 183 points in the first few minutes, but gains faded throughout the afternoon in a late spurt of buying. The Dow ended the day up 27 points, 30 points. It was a lot better than everybody expected. They thought yesterday would be a bloodbath. The day ahead includes the Labor Department releasing its Consumer Price Index for December. That's later this morning. U.S. consumer prices were unchanged in November as declines in energy and food held down overall costs. We're watching a couple of stories of importance here in Chicago and Illinois, especially Governor Rauner and top Republican leaders are planning to introduce legislation that is aimed at financial takeover of the city of Chicago and public school system. This comes in light of a $500 million shortfall within the public school system. There's various reporting on this today, but they could actually change the law to allow the city and the CPS to declare bankruptcy, something that the law currently doesn't allow. There is a news conference involving these legislators later on this morning. Also this morning, the Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump making a little waves as he is saying that he would force Apple, the U.S.'s most profitable company, to manufacture all of its products in the United States if he's elected president. During his speech, he says Apple is one of the few companies, one of the several companies that is making a lot of money but has most of their production outside of the U.S. He also mentioned Chicago in that mix.
Nabisco from Chicago. No more Oreos, folks. Nabisco is moving to, they're moving their big plant from Chicago. They're moving it to Mexico. Ford is building a $2.5 billion plant in Mexico. It's not going to happen. I'm going to say, folks, we got to stop this. We're losing our jobs. We're losing our manufacturing jobs. We got to create jobs. We got to bring back the jobs from China. We got to bring back the jobs from Japan and all these countries that are ripping us off.
During his speech that happened on Martin Luther King Day, Trump also claimed to support free trade, yet insisted he'd impose a 35% tax on businesses producing goods overseas. The Illinois pension mess is one of the big stories of the day as well. Illinois is ranked among one of the worst states in the country, according to a new survey about repaying and taking care of its pension debt. And that's creating a drain on many other sectors of the economy. Of course, Illinois still without a budget. And then there's jobs. Jobs seem to be doing well. Employers seem to be hiring, and the unemployment rate seems to be holding steady. Companies that offer flexible schedules are the winners, it seems, in the markets these days as they look for employees. And the report is out that a study is out that shows that the companies that do offer flexible packages that allow that flex time or allow employees to do things that fit their own schedules as opposed to working a 9-to-5 schedule seem to be the winners in terms of attracting the most best employees. Professor Erin Kelly has just completed a study on this. She's a professor in work and organizational studies at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Professor Kelly's with us on the morning opening bell this morning. Professor, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for getting up with us this morning. Your study, we're going to get into more detail after we check traffic, but give us sort of just a quick thumbnail you've studied Fortune 500 companies, right?
Well, we did a true experiment in a Fortune 500 company, in a single company, and we divided the work groups into two. Half went through this flexibility and support initiative and half didn't, and we followed the employees in those work groups over the course of a year. So we were able to really investigate, do these workplace changes bring benefits to employees in terms of their health and well-being with our study.
So coming up after the break, we're going to dive right into this and find out exactly what is the at the center of the study and what this might mean for other companies. Professor Erin Kelly of MIT will be back with us after we check traffic this morning. Very important as the snow is making travel very hazardous around the Chicago area.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
It's 5:21. Good morning again. We're talking with Erin Kelly, professor in work and organizational studies at the MIT Sloan School of Management, just completed a study of Fortune 500 company employees about flexibility in the workplace. And Professor Kelly, this is something that many people are considering in lieu of pay in many cases. Is that what your study found as well?
No, we didn't. We studied, as I mentioned, Fortune 500 firm and the IT division, and we followed employees over time. So those were already pretty well-paid employees, and the organization didn't institute flexibility in exchange for pay. That might not have the benefits we saw. Instead, they changed the way employees could do their work and encouraged managers to be supportive of people's lives outside of work, and that's where we saw the benefits in terms of job satisfaction, stress, and other things.
Yesterday on our program, we were talking about Zappos and their institution of this holacracy situation. You're familiar with that. Is it like that in any way, or what are the terms of flexibility that you saw or that were instituted?
That's a great question. The flexibility initiative that we studied, we called STAR. And the approach was to ask teams or departments to sit down together and talk through how they did their work. So the idea was, instead of allowing just a couple people who were brave enough to go ask their managers, may I please work at home 2 days a week, or may I change my schedule a little bit, to bring the benefits of flexibility and support to the whole group and have everyone talk through how they did their work, how they needed to coordinate their work, how they wanted to communicate together, and then decide what made sense for their group so that people could get the work done well but still have a lot of control. That's somewhat similar to the impulse behind Holacracy at Zappos, because the idea is let's decentralize some decisions and let's allow employees to have a say in how things work around here. But this STAR initiative didn't go as far as the Zappos reorganization does.
You mentioned early in your answer there about the employees who were brave enough to go in and ask for this. Is fear among employees in terms of asking for these kinds of things, is that a big factor?
Well, I think in most companies, the way flexibility is usually organized, employees are worried about asking for flexibility. So they may fear that it will mean they're less likely to get a promotion, or they may not be reviewed as well, and that could put them at risk if there was a downsizing. We know that some employees would benefit from flexibility, but don't feel that they can negotiate it on their own. And this STAR approach, this collective approach, kind of changes those dynamics and allows employees and managers to talk freely about what they need and how they can get their work done well.
I want to bring in our executive producer of the show, Mary Sandberg. She and I are new to the Tribune Company and WGN. And Mary, when we arrived here, we sort of had, you know, we've been in the business for quite a long time. And this was an issue for both of us, is that we wanted to have this flexibility. And I suppose, you know, the question to you and to the professor is this something that we, you know, can start negotiating? Because you did.
I did, yeah. That was one of the first things that I discussed. I didn't feel compensation wasn't really negotiable. They had pretty much said what it was going to be, but I was okay with that as long as I felt that I had a good work-life balance. And so the one of the first things I said was I wanted to work a off-kilter schedule, so that way if I came in from a typical 9-to-5, I'd be spending about 2.5 hours commuting. I come in on an off schedule, I commute a total of maybe 50 minutes. That happiness, my quote, happiness quotient goes up so much more, not spending all that time in the car. And for me, the value of the position was much greater than if somebody would have paid me more to be here between 9 and 5 strictly.
Yeah. And Professor Kelly, you found that this is, there were reduced levels of stress, not only stress, but levels of burnout. And you saw that the health of the employees improved, didn't you?
That's right. So the main findings in this study are that this new approach to the way we work increased employees' job satisfaction. It reduced their sense of burnout, that feeling of being exhausted by your work and having nothing left to give. And it also reduced stress and psychological distress, which is a measure of depressive symptoms that don't reach clinical depression. So kind of broad impact on employees' well-being in this study.
The money question is, how likely are other Fortune 500 companies and other big companies to institute a flexibility program like this? Do you think this might be something that is able to be replicated?
It certainly would be able to be replicated, and by all kinds of organizations, large firms, small firms, nonprofits, government agencies. It's not specific to some kind of large company necessarily. I think lots of employers want to figure this out. Technology has changed so that employees are available via their smartphones or laptops or whatever. But employees are making themselves available without being able to protect some time for their family lives or their personal lives. This kind of tilts the balance so that employers get the flexibility of being able to connect with employees, but the workers also know they have some say in when and where they do their work, and that's where we see the benefits. I also wanted to mention this was conducted with Phyllis Mullen, my colleague from the University of Minnesota, and the Work Family and Health Network. And our Work Family and Health Network website has the STAR training materials available. The idea was that the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control supported our research, and part of that required us to make the training materials available if people want to pursue this in their own organizations. So that would be terrific to see.
And one thing, Professor Kelly, to point out is it might not be for everybody, because it takes a certain amount of self-discipline to, you know, go home and do some work from home and things like. There are the type of employee that benefit from being in the office with a more strict environment, would you say?
Well, in this approach, the team sits down together and figures out how do we get the work done. And the work is front and center. And so employees are asked to really assess that themselves. And then they're evaluated based on what they get done and their work performance. This approach takes the question from being, can someone negotiate this if they're a great performer, to saying instead, what happens if we all tackle this together? So it's terrific that you were able to negotiate this flexibility. In the approach that we are studying, that would be more broadly available, and employees would be evaluated on their work performance, not on whether they were in the office a certain schedule or doing some work, all of their work on site.
Professor Aaron Kelly, Work and Organizational Studies, Professor of Work and Organizational Studies at MIT Sloan School of Management. Professor, we're going to link to the Work and Family Health Network and more of the materials, and we appreciate you being with us on the opening bell this morning.
And somebody that when I heard that she was going to endorse me, I was so honored. You have no idea how honored.
Our exposure when it came to paying interest could have been much higher. The Iranians were actually seeking $7 to $8 billion in interest payments.
12 in a row for the Chicago Blackhawks. They also tie the Florida Panthers for the longest streak in the National Hockey League this season.
Lots going on in the world today. Sports, news, we'll have it all for you as the day goes along. The Steve Cochran Show coming up at 6 o'clock. We'll have news on the top and bottom of the hours and all of the breaking stuff in between. And that's all coming up at 6. But this is the opening bell on WGN. And turbulence in the banking industry could have some serious implications on bank merger activity in Chicago and the health of banks in general. As a matter of fact, it might already be happening. Take, for example, the case of American Charter Bancorp, a multi-billion-dollar privately held bank in the Chicago area that went up for sale and really stirred little buyer interest. Among seven potential buyers, just two submitted bids. Steve Daniels covers banking, insurance, utility companies for Crane Chicago Business, and Steve is with us on the opening bell this morning. Steve, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Four of seven banks didn't even sign non-disclosure agreements that were in, that may have been in this process. And then the eventual winner was, I mean, this was just sort of a so-so thing. Tell us about what happened here and why it's important.
Well, it's a little unusual because there are so many banks in the Chicago market. This was the biggest privately held bank to come on the market and attempt to sell itself in the Chicago banking market in decades. I mean, it was interesting. I asked a bunch of senior bankers whether they could remember one in their careers, and they couldn't. So, given that there's too many banks in this market by basically, everybody agrees, you see a very large privately held one come on the market. It's, by all accounts, a really well-run bank, fantastic commercial client roster. You would think that the frenzy to buy it would be remarkable, and it was just kind of a little bit of a fizzle. They got a decent price. It wasn't like they weren't able to actually execute an agreement. But you just didn't see the kind of activity that you thought you would with something like that.
Did your reporting find that this is a reason? Was it declining bank stocks? Was it this nature of banks are just not very popular? What was at play here?
No, I think that it had something to do with banks being cautious still in terms of buying a bank like that for many of the banks that would be the natural buyers, which would be the sort of mid-sized banks in the Chicago market, the Wintrust, the private banks, the MB Financials, is a large undertaking with a fair amount of risk. If you don't execute the deal well, if you lose a bunch of bankers and clients, et cetera, it's going to be a real disaster for you. I just think banks are still very cautious, even 8 years removed from the financial crisis, about doing things like that. There's also a lot of concern among bankers regarding regulations and regulators and how they're going to be treated when they undertake significant things like this, too. I think that is at play as well. But I think it has a lot to do with caution. I don't think it has much to, at least back when it happened in late last year, had much to do with the current turmoil in the markets.
How does this filter down to consumers? Will this have any impact on the day-to-day activities of people who are banking customers in the Chicago area?
Well, no. I mean, bank deals are meant to be seamless for customers. Obviously, for the for the many commercial, and just to be clear what American Chartered is, that's a bank that mainly serves mid-sized and smaller businesses. So obviously, and they have, you know, they have a lot of customers. They're pretty sizable for a privately held bank. Yeah, obviously for those borrowers, there's going to be changes. They're going to have a new bank with maybe a few new procedures and the like. But in terms of the broader impact on the market, a deal like that is not going to have an impact.
You mentioned earlier the number of banks that are in the Chicago area, probably more than the area can support. This even after 50 banks failed in 2009. What would be the sweet spot for the number of banks, do you think, in Chicago?
Well, just to be clear, 50 banks failed since 2009.
Since 2000, right, been, right, exactly. Since 2000.
Quite a year.
Right.
How many banks? I don't know. That's a good question. Right now, there's probably roughly 150 in the market locally. Of course, there's a whole bunch of banks in addition to that that aren't headquartered here that operate here. Some of whom are very, very large, like J.P. Morgan Chase or what have you. But you know, I think you look at other markets, it'd probably be 100, maybe. I mean, that's a guess, kind of a wild guess, but. Certainly, I think you talk to anybody in the market, bankers certainly, who compete against each other, and borrowers who actually enjoy the fruits of that competition would say, yeah, there's probably more choice than we require. And for bankers, there's more banks chasing business than might be healthy. So I think it could use some consolidation.
Steve Daniels covers banking, insurance, utilities for Crane Chicago Business. You can read more of his story on the banking industry and this story in particular. You can also find him on Twitter at SteveDaniels27. Steve, thanks for being with us on The Opening Bell.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. It's 5:49. Welcome back to the program. After years of pleading poverty and hitting customers with extra fees, while cutting perks like snacks in the cabin, airlines this week are reporting record profits to make 2015 one of the best year in decades, since well before the federal government stopped regulating fares and routes in 1978. Delta reported its profits Tuesday, more than $1 billion in the last quarter of the year. Rick Cini is founder and CEO of FareCompare.com, at Rick Cini on Twitter. And Rick, Delta saw a pretty good last quarter, didn't it?
Yeah, just a little over $1 billion with a B in net income. Wouldn't we all like to have that? You know, last year through the first three quarters, around $18 billion in net income or profits for airlines last year. Doesn't look like the fourth quarter, which is sort of a big chunk of that's the slow season. Even Thanksgiving and Christmas doesn't make up for that. So this is not exactly what was expected. I think the investment community expected a little bit higher, but for the most part, this just means that airlines are going to make well over. And by the way, we have four airlines that control 80% of domestic traffic are going to make well over $20 billion in profits for 2015.
There is all of the nitpicking, too, with the snacks and all of the fees that they're charging. Oil prices are still falling. I mean, I know they've locked in some of these prices ahead of time. But are we coming to a point where we need to see them start cutting fares a little?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to happen. It has to happen at some point, because typically what happens, and the reason airline ticket prices haven't dropped, and by the way, a couple weeks ago, Delta actually fired an across-the-board increase of $3 each way or $6 round trip. So clearly, you know, they don't have cutting in mind. But what I would say is that typically what you find in these conditions is when you have low oil prices or a huge drop in prices from, say, you know, just under $100 to just under $40, you have an economic shock. That's not happened yet. There's still decent demand for airline ticket prices. There is an ongoing Department of Justice investigation on what they call capacity control and whether or not they're coordinating on whether or not to add more seats back into the system. So there's regulated the amount of supply. Demand is still pretty good. There's no reason to drop prices, even though they're getting windfall profits from fuel.
You mentioned something at the beginning about these few airlines controlling pretty much all of the routes. Isn't that enough to sort of spark interest at the Justice Department?
Well, they did to some degree, right? So you had these four huge mega mergers started six and a half years ago with Delta Northwest, then United Continental, and then you had Southwest and AirTran merging. And then the last one, American Airlines and U.S. Airways, was actually initially blocked by the Department of Justice. Then after some tweaking and some other changing, they let it go through. So, you know, basically the government's given their stamp of approval to this 80% of traffic. Now, I will say that there's going to be a lot of airlines out there, if we can have sustained fuel under $50 a barrel, that have business plans for startup airlines. And so if we can do that, we'll see more competition. In lieu of that, I don't expect much to happen, other than the fact that if the U.S. economy starts to slow down, we will definitely see ticket prices drop dramatically.
On the Martin Luther King weekend, we saw protests at many airports, some of them involving some airline employees who are protesting what they get paid, some of them below the average, minimum wage in some cases, or just above, with record profits. Is that a fair wage to be paying some of those folks?
It's hard for me to say what's fair or not, but I do know one thing. When I'm flying, I want the mechanic to be the highest paid one, the pilot to be the highest paid person. I want them to be happy all the time. And, you know, in these particular instances, I'm positive that, you know, these negotiations through each airline, each of the unions for all those folks are going to definitely note these huge windfall profits. Here's the thing is that airlines will say, and we see the same argument on fuel surcharges, because the average fuel surcharge in the U.S. to Europe is still $450 round trip. They're going to say, well, what happens if oil jumps back up to 80 or 90 in a couple months? And, you know, while we're saying, why don't you drop ticket prices while you have these windfall profits? And that will continue to see that refrain until we see sustained oil prices, or people, start to revolt and say, hey, I'm just not going to buy tickets anymore. I'm driving now.
Yeah, and you forgot to mention the baggage guy, too, because you want your luggage to arrive.
That's right. To the extent that you do check luggage, and by the way, last year people did that to the tune of about $4 billion, then you definitely want it to arrive at your final destination. Now, I will say that the stats on airlines, the major stats like, mishandling of baggage and departures and returns being on time, have all gotten better. The main reason for that is we don't have a lot of traffic out there, and we have less people checking bags.
We have about a minute left, but I want to leave our listeners on a high note. Do you have any good fares, any nice deals out there?
Yeah, look, I mean, there are some great deals. I was just looking out of Chicago at the end of February. Now, remember, the last part of February is sort of the off-season time, but if you sort of spin around the United States, if you're going to the Northwest, you have Seattle under $255 round trip. That's a great deal. You have Southern California, Los Angeles, San Diego, and even, you know, a little bit further north in California, San Francisco, under $205 round trip. And if you're going out to the Northeast, you've got Boston, New York, Washington, all under $160 round trip. Miami and Orlando down in South Florida and in Midwest Florida, under $200 round trip. So those are great deals. So once the one thing I will note is that airlines know exactly when your spring break is in the Chicago area. They raise prices dramatically for Saturday, Sunday departures, bracketing your spring break. So the best trip for spring break is Tuesday to Saturday. That's where you're going to find the deals.
Rick Cini, founder and CEO of FareCompare.com. You can see me on Twitter. Thanks for being on The Opening Bell.
Hey, thank you.
And this is The Opening Bell. As we close out, just a quick recap of some of the markets this morning. The Dow futures are lower today. They have been lower about 297 points now, but they've been in triple digits lower territory throughout the last hour or so. S&P 500 is the futures off 34 as well. Asian markets overnight, all of them lower. The Hang Seng was off 750 points. Shanghai was off 31. Nikkei off 632. Again, Dow futures off triple digits this morning. The Opening Bell, the executive producer, Mary Sandberg, thank you. Our engineer is Ben Cortez. Thanks for production help from Kevin Powell and Ross Cochran. We'll be back with you bright and early tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock for the business of life and the business of money, The Opening Bell. The Steve Cochran Show is coming up next.